Hello, and welcome to a roundtable discussion on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by guests for a lively conversation on a topic we hope you'll find interesting. In this episode, we are going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on Star Trek Discovery, The Enterprise War. This is a novel written by John Jackson Miller, whom I've met a number of times. I know him. Not going to say we're buddy-buddy or whatever, but he's a good guy. I like him. And I have also read some of his comics he's written, specifically some of the Star Wars stuff he'd done over at Dark Horse. So my sister and I have read the book. It's been a few days since we read it. Just took us a little while to coordinate the recording and such. And this basically explains what the Enterprise is doing essentially during the first season or so of Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Up until we see them at the end. Now, obviously John wrote the book. He's the author. Go figure. There was some stuff at the end on how he was coordinating with the showrunners for what they thought the Enterprise was doing, so he could kind of be in line with that, which I thought was good. Unclear where certain ideas may have come from or whatever. Overall, I thought this was a fun read. It focused a lot on Pike.
Yes.
I felt that we got the Pike from second season pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
We got Spock. We got number one. There weren't really many other Enterprise crew members from second season of Discovery to really have around. We did get Dr. Boyce, I think it was, from the cage, in other words, the original go-round of Pike's crew, and there was a mention of Scotty having been aboard, but never even him as a young ensign or what have you to speak of, which is a little disappointing, but okay. In place of Scotty as chief engineer, we get a guy who is, apparently it's a rotating position on the Enterprise. It's the flagship, so whoever wants to be thought of as the great big engineer of Starfleet gets it. And this was a guy who was a academically brilliant person who had invented many of the technologies used on the Enterprise, but alas, not so good at actually using the technologies.
Yeah.
And I felt that made for a very interesting kind of twist on, I don't want to say the anti-Scotty.
No, but he had a moment of revelation about three-quarters of the way through the book where he says, you know, I'd reached the point where I had the ideas and then I gave it to my assistants to do the work. And I'd lost touch with physically doing the work, with having contact with the panels. And this has been educational for me to learn it all again.
I could see John Billingsley.
Mm.
Play this character.
Yes.
The guy who can have the bravado, but also have the humility to say, you know what? You're right. I don't know this interface the way I should if I'm going to be on the bridge during that sort of an incident.
Yes.
I messed up. I need to do better. You know? And I thought that evolution of that character arc,
mm-hmm.
was well done here.
Yeah.
Even if it took a little bit of forcing story-wise to get all the other engineers into the hull section,
yes.
only him in the saucer section, and then split the two.
Yes.
You know, oh wait, all the engineers are over there. But it was done in a believable way.
Yeah.
So it's not, oh, come on, you know? So I enjoyed the book a lot. I think it was well-told, well-written. There was a few things that, and again, don't know whose creative decision these things were, I would have done differently, or at least tried to do differently.
Well, I had a feeling about the Rengru and what their actual purpose was early on.
I guess
after one of the first physical battles.
What I would have done differently is at a bigger picture than that. This takes place over the course of about a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all one adventure, if you will, versus feeling more episodic.
Mm.
Like if they had had an Enterprise season one taking place concurrently with Discovery.
Yeah.
you know, we're in that serial narrative. So you've got them being in this nebula and trying to get out to find out what's going on with the Klingon war that broke out. Oh, stay there. We don't need you. Okay, that's fine. But them encountering both the Ringu and the
Boundless.
Thank you. And dealing with that for over a year, including many of the crew members being taken by the Boundless, put into servitude there. And when they got this battle armor that they basically live in for that duration of a year, on the one hand, it made sense, it didn't seem outrageous, but it didn't feel iconic Trek.
No, but I think that was the point. We were totally outside Federation space.
We were, but we're doing it at a point in time where we've seen so much Trek afterwards to not have had any trickle down. If this had been something where, oh, you know what? Now that I think about it, I see where this race or this technology came from this sort of adventure.
I guess so. Part of my takeaway was most of the guys who went in the battle armor came out traumatized.
Even if there had been some, and maybe there wasn't, I missed it, indication that at some point the Borg had encountered this, and that's what had led to the technological upgrades of the Borg. I don't know, something. Because it's not Borg-like.
Yeah, no.
But it feels actually more like the kind of battle armor and stuff that we were seeing over in the Lost Fleet series of novels.
Yes.
Than a Star Trek one. Wasn't out of place. It made sense. It was well used in terms of you've got the Boundless that are constantly recruiting people. They need to train them. They need to get them up to speed.
Recruitment is a very loose term.
Enslave. Or imprison in the suits.
Yes.
And that part I thought was well done.
That was fascinating.
Yeah. The whole concept of you've got this spacesuit thing that you're living in for the rest of your life, essentially.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting if one or two of the crew members were either underweight or overweight or something. This either fixed it, caused problems, it couldn't adjust to their metabolism, something.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't fit as well as it used to. But it worked for the story to take place over the duration. I just didn't care for it.
Mm.
It felt, the pacing felt odd.
See, for me, the duration was required for Spock.
I guess for me, it precludes other stories of Spock during that time frame because it accounts for all of his time. Whereas if it had been a key mission at one point, right before they came back, or early in the year, or something.
But I think they wanted this to set Spock up directly into Discovery Season 2.
Absolutely. And Pike, and Number One, even. So I do think a lot of those creative decisions were kind of from the showrunner's side, not from John Jackson Miller's side. And again, I'm not saying they were bad decisions.
Well, but, I mean, when you look at it from that perspective, you needed Spock questioning his sanity, which is why he was on Scon's world,
mm-hmm.
alone.
Well, and also seeing the Red Angel.
Yes.
To set up that whole storyline and kind of crack him that way.
Yeah.
But it would have been nice to have had a little bit of a line of, hey, we dropped him off at the Starbase, he said not to tell his family, or, you know, something.
Yeah.
But it's also a reflection of modern storytelling, because if you look back at first season of Discovery, it was kind of sort of all one big story anyways.
Yes, yes.
So I think this fit with that.
Yeah.
But again, you compare it to, say, the original voyages of the original Enterprise on TV, you've got a lot more episodic sort of stuff also in the books.
Yeah. Now, this alluded to one of the previous books.
It did, where Michael Burnham and Spock had interacted together as the Sinju and the Enterprise had worked together. It was unclear which book that was.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about that, because it also, the lead time on this kind of a novel precludes really tight integration of the author with the show.
Yes.
Because they're all doing their own things and whatnot. So it flew a little in the face of, oh, I haven't talked to Spock in years. And this implied it was fewer years than we had been led to believe in the show.
But I think that's because of the previous novel, not this novel.
Yes.
He had to acknowledge the previous novel, in other words.
And the show didn't.
Yes.
So the question is, when was that written versus which?
Yeah.
And as long as they play close enough, and I feel they did, I'm not worried about it, I'm not upset by it, but that is one of the challenges of doing novels based on an ongoing show.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to write original Enterprise stories that fit between episodes of the original series, because you've had plenty of time to think about it.
Yes. Yeah.
Or if plenty of time has elapsed, whether you've had the time to think about it, it's another matter.
And details.
But I particularly enjoyed this insight into that Enterprise, the version of Pike and stuff like that. It was well done, and it felt like the character we'd seen on second season of Discovery. Which, again, given the coordination problems that had to have been around, I thought was well done.
Well, and it's funny, because whether it was done on purpose or not, he picked up on what Anson Mount had said in one of the panels we went to, where he said he went into every scene trying to be what the other character needed from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much what this Pike in the book was doing.
I'm really curious how much John Jackson Miller knew about second season of Discovery, about the take on Pike. Well, was Spock even cast at that point? Because the whole addition of the beard could have just happened in the, he's going to need a beard. Let's put that in here, kind of thing. It fit perfectly in the story, but that could have been happenstance. It could have been planned.
Yeah.
It's hard to know. Either way, it felt like an organic precursor to second season in a good way.
Yeah.
And it was something that had a different enough take on the Prime Directive as to not be, oh geez, another Prime Directive story, but to not be that either.
Yes.
And when you had early on indications of Spock asking, well, where do your loyalties lie? And then you see one of the characters start to veer a little too far off down the pike, and then getting course corrected.
Well, and we see to degrees the way he has rationalized it and the way he deals with how he rationalized it. You know.
And it's one of those things that while it takes place over the course of about a year or so, we're with the characters throughout that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like suddenly, we skipped a couple of months and what the hell happened? It's the changes are earned.
Well, and in fact, that character, Connolly, manages to create among the Boundless a competition to have the most recruits survive being recruited, which is this new and novel concept.
Well, and the whole use of sabermetrics and whatnot and sort of, his interest in sports playing into this.
Yes.
Was just enough to be interesting, but not enough to be annoying.
Yes.
And I felt a lot of the characters we got new to me in this book were well introduced, well fleshed out, and had a good arc throughout. I think the engineer probably had the best of them.
Yes.
But Connolly had a good solid one. There were a few other characters.
Yeah.
And again, I enjoyed seeing a Dr. Boyce, who again, I think was from the original version of this crew, well used here. And it's one that if you liked second season of Discovery, want to find out more about Enterprise, I do think this is worth reading.
Well, and these characters stay true to what we consider to be, or I consider to be, the Federation ideals.
Mm-hmm.
When they understand what's at the heart of this war, they don't just rescue their people and get out. They help these two sides to understand each other.
To me, that goes back to the take on Pike in Discovery. That's who he is.
Yes.
And the whole scene he had of, why was I sidelined? And he was told, you're the best of us.
Yes.
You're what we want to keep out there.
Yeah.
And it's funny because that's not always the take we get. We've had a couple of times in various Trek shows or whatever that the guy goes rogue or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And very few that are the personification of what Starfleet wants to be.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure that any of the other captains fit the bill. I don't think anyone considers Janeway the pinnacle of what a Starfleet captain should be. I certainly don't think Sisko falls into that. Mm. Not to say they were bad captains or bad characters.
Yeah.
Even Kirk and Picard. Kirk's the cowboy, Picard's more the diplomat.
Yeah.
Neither's enough of the other.
Yeah.
That to have this character personify that, but not be put on a pedestal for it.
Yeah.
Was a nice balancing act, both here and in the show.
Well, and part of it is that the book allows him to have his doubts, his concerns, his fear that if my goal is to keep my crew of 200 alive, and I just lost half of them between saucer separation and prisoners being taken.
That's part of why I'm curious how much John knew about the show, if he'd had the chance to see any footage or any of that, because I'm not sure. This was a fairly newish release.
It came out about the time of Comic-Con 2019.
I'm trying to think if it was newish compared to when season 2 was. I don't remember. If he wrote this not having seen any of Anson Mount's performance, kudos to him. Clearly there was enough communication back and forth for him to get the gist of the character.
Yeah.
Because I think Anson Mount's version of Christopher Pike was sufficiently different than the original actor, Jeffrey Hunter, I want to say.
Yeah, I
could be wrong on that, though. That was a more stoic captain, whereas Anson Mount's was a bit more feeling, a bit more, I won't say conflicted, but having to work at doing the right thing.
Yes.
It came naturally, but not easy.
Well, yeah. He, like in the Discovery episode, where he is shown his future.
Yes, that was really well done.
Yes.
There was also an aspect of, let's have fun here while we're doing it, that he'd had in an early episode. He really, to me, elevated the show quite a bit in the second season.
Yes.
And all of what I liked about his character there, I felt we got here.
Well, and part of why I wanted to read this is it really feels like this and that aspect of second season Discovery could launch an Enterprise show.
I certainly hope it does. And even if it doesn't, I hope they branch off from Discovery to do more Enterprise books.
Yeah.
The problem there becomes branding.
Mm.
Because you've got to brand it in a way that makes sure it's set during the Discovery time frame and take not the Enterprise show.
Yeah.
Or the original Enterprise from the original series.
Pike's Enterprise.
Yeah. Yeah. They've gotten themselves into a bit of a sticky wicket there.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, if John Jackson Miller or similar authors do more of this, I'd be into it.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was fun, it was a good read, and there were a couple of things. Oh, we've got site to site, but oh, we can't use it for anything. Got some limits on it. Mm-hmm. Okay, that fits the era.
Yeah.
There was a few comments about the holographic technology and not working on the Enterprise and him not wanting it to work on the Enterprise.
Yes.
Again, fit in line with
and having gotten the new uniforms.
Yes. I was curious, because it wouldn't surprise me if some of that had maybe come from John towards, you know, hey, you got the holograms. They don't have it on Enterprise. How if we handle it this way? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It did feel there was some course correction season 2 to account for season 1 not feeling as Trekkish.
Yes.
But they handled that well. And this covered the ground it needed to, explained why they weren't where they felt they should have been.
Mm-hmm. And it gave them a worthwhile mission in the end. The initial Survey the Nebula mission, not the most thrilling, not the greatest, but what they ended up doing was really quite remarkable.
Yes, it wasn't a waste of their time to be there. And I don't remember the shape the Enterprise was in when Pike took over Discovery, but it was clearly in need of repairs, and this established why.
Yeah.
You know, whether they needed the same repairs, don't know, but you know what I mean.
Well, and the fact that the Rengru helped them put the ship back together.
Yes. Although when we first saw it, it did not look worse for wear.
Mm.
So there's a little of that. But at that point, that was the end of season 1, so they can be forgiven for not having figured everything out that far in advance. It's an era and a crew that I do want to see more of.
Yes.
And again, what we got here was good. If they continue with this, I'd like to see Scotty from that era.
Yeah.
But they're at the point where we've got multiple takes already on Spock. at that same age from the original Leonard McCoy, Leonard Nimoy, sorry, the original Leonard Nimoy version from the pilot even, which fit here, to the show, to the version that was then done with Zach Quinto on the movies, and now by Ethan Peck on Discovery. And there's a couple of, hey, you don't need to shout, which is a reference to the original pilot, you know, stuff like that. This, when I was reading it, I heard the right voices.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
And part of it was knowing it was the Discovery stuff, and part of it was written like the Ethan Peck Spock, not the Leonard Nimoy one or the Zach Quinto one.
Yeah.
And it's hard to pinpoint the differences. There was an IDW Star Trek comic that had, it was beautifully done comic, the original crew version, or the original version of the original crew, meeting the Abrams crew, with a little bit of, you remember the episode where Worf's bouncing back in time? A little of that sort of thing going on. So you would have the Chris Pine Kirk with the old crew. And then, hey, you know, it's flipping around kind of a deal. And the author really got the dialogue right for how which Spock would say what, how which Kirk would say what.
Yeah.
In the right hands, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But it's also the job of an author to know, to channel the right version of a character.
Yeah.
Which is not crazy hard to do, but it's more challenging now that there are the different variants of Spock.
Yes.
And of Pike. Less so for number one, because I didn't think she was used heavily in the original pilot.
No.
But I thought this was fun. I thought the alien races were interesting. I thought the Boundless and how they all work was well fleshed out. The opposing side, the Ringu, or whatever, it was clear that there was going to be a they're not the evil side, we've got to understand sort of thing.
Well, but more than that, the first time we saw them in kind of face-to-face battle, when they made contact and tried to wrap around the same way the armor wraps around a person, that's when I thought, okay, they could replace the armor. Oh, wait, they could replace the armor.
Yeah.
It was kind of a, wait, what it did I just think?
It made sense, but didn't feel overly telegraphed.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's to Miller's credit, because...
It was shown.
And when the races were taken to the homeworld to be shown,
yes,
this is what you're fighting for and from, and there's a miscommunication here, because whenever they try to communicate, you kill them.
Yes, well, and the miscommunication was started by a miscommunication and perpetuated because they never sent out a replacement message, basically.
Yeah.
And I can see where Carmagon, I guess her name was very upset with Great Mother Yuta for just letting us all believe the Ringu are going to be the end of us.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, 500 waves. They didn't say each wave was a generation, but they made it sound like, what, a 100-year war or more?
I didn't take it as that long, because it was hard to tell.
Carmagon was 100.
All right, so it had to be at least that long.
And her mother had been fighting, and her grandmother had been fighting.
Yeah. It had been going on for a significant time. We just don't know how long they live.
Yeah.
100 years in the nebula versus 100 Earth years.
Yeah.
But it was...
Well, Great Mother Yuta, thanks to the Ringu, was still alive.
Yes. It made sense. It worked.
Yeah.
And it was, for lack of a better term, a novel idea. That it's not one we'd seen 1,000 times before.
Yeah, exactly.
And the seemingly never-ending war, okay, a bit of a staple or whatever, but it made sense in terms of how both sides kept it going so long.
Well, and the one bonding with number one meant that we could see both how it worked, but also that they could choose to separate.
Yes. Well, and also it worked because of her highly organized mind.
Yes.
I would like to see more backstory on that character, because she's played as somewhere between a mirror image opposite number and a clone of Spock.
Yeah.
They're very similar and very different in some ways, and I want to see that explored more.
Yeah.
Ideally through novels and TV.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was well done both places. I haven't really looked into the other Discovery novels?
Neither have I. I picked up the first one, but I haven't had time to read it.
Okay, what's the title of that one?
Desperate Hours.
That might be the one this was referring to. I'm not sure.
There's one called Drastic Measures that has seemingly the two Mirror Universe characters on the cover.
Okay.
And then Fear Itself has...
Saru.
Thank you. And The Way to the Stars has the curly-haired officer.
Tilly.
Thank you, Tilly.
I could see where some people could pick this novel up, seeing Star Trek Discovery, thinking it was going to be about Discovery, missing the whole Enterprise War being future in Enterprise. Burnham is mentioned a time or two. Obviously, Spock and Pike are pivotal in this.
Yeah.
Focuses on them. But the crew of Discovery itself never shows up here.
Yeah. I mean, the captain of Shenzhou is mentioned as killed in action.
Well, periodically we get messages from Fleet.
Yeah.
Starfleet and stuff of, hey, stay there, here's what's going on.
Yeah.
I would have appreciated if those had been a little more fleshed out.
Mm.
I get, hey, you can only send so much, but...
They were tweets.
This is the future and it's text.
They were tweets.
You could spend more than 280 characters. Also, a footnote... To give us a reference as to, oh, this is this point in the show.
Yes.
Would have been nice.
Yeah.
But I like those kinds of things. I could see how they're not in popular favor these days.
Yeah.
Because there were a couple of times, it's like, you're mentioning this, but it's been long enough since I watched first season. It's like, when did this happen? Are you talking about here? Are you talking about there?
Yeah.
Battle of the Binary Stars, I think that was the pilot episode. This yep. other one, I'm not sure.
Battle of the Binary Stars was the beginning, and it was where the replacement captain allegedly got the eye damage.
Hmm.
And that's why it kept getting mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah, with Lorca.
Yes. Yes. And then we found out, oh, wait, the eye damage is actually code for he's from the Mirror Universe.
Yeah, I thought they played acceptably fair on that. Not that we ever saw any indication of any other Mirror Universe stuff, but
we
can live with that.
So, but no, I enjoyed this book. It was, for me, it was a page-turner. I just kept going.
For me, it was a page-turner. It was an easy read, but so much happened in it that it felt like it was taking longer than it was.
Yeah. Yeah, because for me it was very immersive and just engrossing and just, wow, I can't believe time has passed, so much has happened. You know, I was expecting the baby to be born on the ship. I don't think it was.
Don't think so, but that was a nice subplot to have.
Well, and he played it really nice because at first Una had asked the doctor how many people were over on the saucer section, and he'd said 100, and she didn't correct him to 99. And then we get over to Pike, and somebody says 100, and he corrects them to 99.
And she's like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was well done.
Yeah.
Having the Enterprise saucer flipped over on a gas planet, essentially.
That was fun.
And therefore, they're always on the roof versus the thing. And it's like, okay, I can see how that happens. And then having to solve the problem of, how do you get the saucer out and back into space?
Well, and how do you not get injured when you flip it?
Yes.
That was clever.
They did some good stuff, and that's something where it's like, set some minor problems up, let them ponder it, fix it. We didn't get a bunch of technobabble. We didn't get it glossed over. It was a nice balance on that stuff.
Well, and we had Spock on the other world helping,
mm-hmm.
which was nice.
Well, we wound up with multiple groups to follow at some point.
Mm-hmm.
The main... A whole section of the Enterprise, the saucer section, Spock, the people still with the Boundless.
Yeah.
But it never felt like we were ignoring one to go spend time with the other. We just kept moving in a fluid, you know, rotation or bouncing around that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'd be, hey, it's been a while. Oh, we're getting Spock now. Okay, I'm good. You know, so the spacing of that was pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
There have been other books where by the time I get back to something, I'd forgotten that the character was in play at all.
I know that feeling.
But it surprised me, because on a Kindle, and we got the ebook version of it, it's going to take you roughly 6-7 hours to read it or whatever. And it feels like I'm reading for a while. I'm only so far into it, and it's in, yet I'm still on that path.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not slower than I think, but it feels both more immersive and more meaty.
Yes.
Than many other novels I've got.
Yeah.
There have been some where I feel that they're just skimming the surface of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read a few in the past, and I think it was Once Upon a Time in the East. It was a time travel book kind of a deal. Man, it was a page turner. It just sailed through it, and it was fun, but it was a light-hearted surface read. It was a good plot, and I'm not saying anything disparaging about it when I say that, but it wasn't one you had to ponder over.
Yes, yeah.
It was the one where they would do, you know how you have that shootout at high noon, tumbleweed goes by? That literal sort of scene happened, and the guy wrote it in a way that it felt very cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
The guy, a talented author there. And again, here, the writing was such that you felt the humor when you needed to, the seriousness when you needed to, the plot kept moving.
Yeah.
Not at the expense of the characterization never got in the way of the plot. And it was easy to read. And in a good way, felt like it was taking longer than it was. There was more to it than you might expect.
One of the things I really appreciated, and to me, it's a small but meaningful touch, those daily transmissions between Pike and Spock.
Yeah.
Because in the original series, when Pike has been injured beyond recovery, really,
it goes to the relationship the two have.
Yes. And Spock is willing to take him back to the planet because he knows why he wants to go back to Vina, and he gets it. And for me, this set up the bond they have and why Spock would do that for him.
I would say the episode of second season of Discovery to rewatch before or after reading this is the one where he's got that premonition.
Mm.
Where they go to the Klingon planet and Pike learns of his future.
Yeah.
Because that's the one where I think we started with the original Cage, and it kind of shifts into this crew retelling it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a beautiful acknowledgement of, yep, we know we got new actors, but this is the original timeline, you know.
Yeah.
We're just updating it a little.
Well, because when we originally watched the original series, it was... We only know them from one episode.
Yep.
We don't know enough about their relationship to know why.
The stuff we'd gotten in the two-parter that had reintroduced Pike was using footage from the unaired pilot. So it wasn't really a reintroduction of Pike. It was the introduction of Pike. And told via flashbacks, whatever. Whereas seeing Pike, knowing he knows what his future's going to be, he can avoid it, but he can't.
Yeah.
It's not who he is.
Yeah.
There's a core of that character that I think shows up not only through the rest of Discovery, but in this book.
Yeah.
And I think that character, while interesting originally back in the day, Anson Mount really elevated to a whole new level.
I agree.
And again, I want to see more of it.
Yeah.
So I thought this was a solid read. Definitely one I would recommend if you're into Star Trek novels. Not everybody is into novels based on a TV show. I get it. Again, I know John Jackson Miller. Talked to him a number of times over the years. Had him on the podcast a few times. Probably ought to do that again. But, you know, even if I didn't know him, I'd have the same feelings on the book.
Yeah.
You know, he's a talented writer. He is a geek at heart. Clearly knows his Star Trek stuff well. This is not the first Star Trek novel he's written. He's written three others that were part of a Prey storyline, and I think a few before that, a good couple of Star Wars novels, wrote 50 issues of, I think it was Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, maybe, where it was totally new characters, but man, he captured the tone, the style, the feel of the Star Wars universe.
Nice.
So, his writing I enjoy and do recommend.
Cool.
And, of course, he's got the Comic-Con website on the number crunching, so it can't be all bad. So, anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.